First Amendment freedoms, and government transparency. This is the foundation to a healthy democracy. Welcome to the NEFAC Report, where we discuss your rights to free speech, freedom of the press, and an open, accountable government. I'm Alexandra Tavallone, production manager for the NEFAC Report and part of a student team at Roger Williams University working with the New England First Amendment Coalition. Thanks for joining us. On this episode, we'll be hearing from Granite State News Collaborative Director and NEFAC Advisor Melanie Plenda. Melanie helped launch a program with NEFAC and the Naki S. Loeb School of Communications in New Hampshire called CivDoc, or Civic Documenters. The program helps increase press coverage of local municipal meetings and teaches community members how to better engage with government. Later in the show, we'll hear from journalist and NEFAC advisor Todd Wallach about the challenges reporters face obtaining search warrant records in Massachusetts. Todd will explain how this prevents us from learning about law enforcement investigations and why it is making it difficult for us to keep police accountable. But first, here's Justin and Melanie.
Melanie, thanks for being here. I want to have you discuss this program that you've really taken the lead on with the help of NEFAC and the Naki Loeb School called CivDoc, Civic Documenters. Can you tell us what this is all about?
I sure can. Thanks so much again for having me. This was sort of an amalgamation of a lot of different good ideas. So I had been working with Naki Loeb on a version of a community journalism class where we were teaching community members just basically how to cover their communities, doing kind of soft news. And this was based sort of on a program that was happening at the University of Vermont at the time. We wanted to see how we could tweak it and have it here. The more that I worked with my partners in the Granite State News Collaborative, the local news partners, the more I really was seeing the need for local news coverage of municipal meetings, of school board meetings. All of these big decisions were happening. And, you know, a lot of outlets just don't have the resources and staff to cover them all. And so we decided, well, what could we do to sort of put together a program that taught people how to cover these local municipal meetings? We created a curriculum for community members to be able to learn how to cover their own communities. And then just briefly from there, we connected up with a few pilot newsrooms willing to work with community members. We had three different cohorts, two in the Monadnock region and one in the Lakes region, who worked with the Laconia Daily Sun, the Monadnock Ledger Transcript, and the Keene Sentinel.
Explain for us why there's a need for this program.
I can tell you one reason it's not for lack of caring by the newsrooms, which is often how community members interpret not seeing reporters at those meetings. Local newsrooms absolutely understand the importance of those meetings, and they have been gutted. Newsrooms have been getting smaller and smaller for the past few decades now. And we really see that at the local municipal level. So they have to triage a bit, and they can only send out reporters on kind of the big splashy things or the things that raise to their level, as opposed to previously when newsrooms were just chock-a-block full of reporters, they could send out their beat reporters. A reporter might have one town as their one and only beat.
Now enter CivDoc.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about the curriculum. How does the selection process work as far as identifying individuals that would be a good fit for the program?
Initially, how it starts is, like I said, we partner with a local newsroom. We get applicants. They do fill out an application. We just want to make sure that if we're getting folks who already serve on a board, that they're not going to cover a board that they already serve on. So we're looking for different kinds of conflicts of interest like that, or people who, you know, maybe very obviously have political agendas. We really want people who their sole focus is just getting information out to the community. And so they go through the application process. They go through about 6 weeks of workshops. It's usually about an hour and a half, one class per week. We break the workshops down. What we really wanted them to understand is, one, how does a meeting actually work? What do these different committees and boards do? What are the kinds of things that might jump out to you if you're there as a reporter covering the meetings? Once they go through this process, they meet with their host newsroom. They get a template that they can use to take notes. The civic documenter then goes to different meetings that they sign up for, and they take the notes. They turn those around in about 24 hours to 48 hours to the news outlet. The news editor then reads the notes and decides if it's worthy of following up on a more extensive story, or sometimes the notes are so good, they just run it as a brief, which is great. This has led to people taking notes at meetings where no one thought there was going to be a reporter there, and things happened that the civic documenter was able to capture and record and take to a reporter, and it got out in the paper. And one example in particular was something crazy, like it was the tax rate or something like that in one of these towns in the Monadnock region was going to jump by like something astronaut, like 20%, and no one else was at this meeting, and they hadn't put it in the agenda, they hadn't put it anywhere, but the civic documenter was there and went to the editor and said, I think this might be a big deal, and here's the information, and they were able to get that story. So I love this program. I love it for so many reasons. One, because it helps the news outlets, which in turn can help the community. But honestly, it gets community members excited about their community, and it explains the community to community members. It allows them to access these meetings. So even if they never wrote a word for any other local outlets, the fact that they now are able to go to a meeting and understand what's happening and then maybe participate themselves, I think is a worthwhile thing to do.
And that's why NEFAC got involved, because there are two major goals here. One, we want to help newsrooms by providing notes and support for their news gathering, have individuals in the room that can alert an editor, like in the example that you provided, that, hey, there's a story here, something that you need to dive in deeper and take a look at. But then on the other side, there's also the civic engagement part of this, where even if these individuals drop from the program, no longer have a relationship with the newsroom, aren't feeding information to reporters, they're still engaging with government at a level that they weren't before. And that's a great thing, too. So you're really accomplishing through CivDoc two major goals that ultimately will help us stay better informed and more engaged with our communities through local government. And I think it's also important to note as well, you know, the individuals chosen here aren't chosen to replace journalists or even practice journalism. They're just to be present at these meetings to take notes to then provide to an editor so they can say, oh, you know, we didn't have somebody at this meeting otherwise, but now I know what happened and maybe something that happened at this meeting requires a little bit more attention. And then they can designate one of their journalists, somebody on their staff to look into it. Is that right?
Exactly. And to that point, in fact, and this is a small point, but I think it goes to what you're saying. We offer a small stipend to have community members cover the meetings. Maybe out of the 20, maybe 30 who've gone through the program, literally only two have ever invoiced me. And I've gone to them. We need to pay you. I want to pay you. And they never return an invoice to me. And I've had people reach out and say, you don't have to pay me the stipend. I just want to do this. We're not having them replace reporters. They can't replace reporters. And many of them don't want to. They just want to be able to get that information out to community members. And this is a great way to do that.
Let's move forward now into potentially a third cohort. What are plans for the program? How are we going to proceed in getting that third group together? Are there any newsrooms that have raised their hand and said, you know, we want to partner? What does the future of this program look like?
Yes to all of that. Yes, there will be a third cohort. There was some recent changeover at the Nacky Loeb School. So the executive director, Laura Simoes, who we all love, she is moving on to other things. And they've brought on a new executive director who we're very excited to work with. She's very excited to see the program continue. She literally just started as of the date of this taping. So I'm going to give her a little time to get her sea legs, but then we're going to jump in, start tweaking some of that curriculum that we had. We got some great feedback, both from newsrooms and from the cohorts that went through the program with the last iteration, that we want to try to integrate into the curriculum, maybe pare it back a little bit, have a little more hands-on time where we're working with the cohort where they can actually maybe go to meetings while they're still taking the class with us. We can answer questions, things like that. Late spring, early summer, we're going to put out another announcement for the next cohort that'll start in the fall. As for the newsrooms, we have had a couple of newsrooms. I will say I was surprised by the ones that raised their hand, but I was thrilled. So we have had a few who've shown some interest. So I think once we are closer to finalizing that new curriculum, we'll be able to sign up a new newsroom and get that off the ground. But then the plan is to have the next one up and running by fall.
That's great. A lot of exciting things in store. I would encourage everyone to go to nefac.org/civdoc to learn more about the program and to sign up to our newsletters to make sure that they're informed of any news regarding this new cohort to be announced later this spring, early summer. Melody, thanks so much for joining us and walking us through this program, telling us about all the great things that CivDoc has provided.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
I'm Ed Fitzpatrick, a reporter at the Boston Globe, a NEFAC board member, and the host of the Rhode Island Report podcast. Our Globe Rhode Island team is based in Providence, providing daily digital coverage of all things Rhode Island. We also have a daily roadmap newsletter and a weekly Rhode Island Food Club newsletter. We conduct investigations, holding the people in power accountable. We tell the stories that make Rhode Island so unique. And we remain committed to helping student journalists play a vital role in our democracy. To learn more, go to globe.com/Rhode Island.
Hey, this is Alexandra again. If you want to learn more about the topics being discussed in this episode, please take a look at our show notes. A link is provided wherever you're listening to this podcast. These notes include NEFAC resources, information on CivDoc, and so much more. Now, let's hear reporter Todd Wallach's discussion with Justin about the difficulties obtaining search warrant records from Massachusetts courts.
Hey, Todd, I want you to speak to us about search warrant documents, search warrants, applications for search warrants in Massachusetts and how difficult they can be to obtain. But first, tell us the story of Alvin Campbell and the reporting that you and your colleagues did at WBUR that really informed you about this particular issue.
Sure. Alvin Campbell is one of the most well-known accused serial rapists in Massachusetts at the moment. He also happens to be the brother of Attorney General Andrea Campbell. And I was working with a reporter, Walter Wolfman, looking at that case, and we're wondering why it took so many rapes before he was arrested and what happened. So we were trying to first look at the court documents and other records that were available. And one of the things we ran into is that there's a type of court document that's supposed to be public called search warrant. We thought we knew which courthouse it was filed in, and the reporter asked by email, he asked on the phone, he went there in person and kept getting a consistent message from the court clerks that they couldn't find it. The rules are very clear in Massachusetts. These records are supposed to be public. And in this case, the records contained invaluable information that showed police had evidence and had 4 prior reports of rapes before they eventually arrested him after a 5th victim came forward. There were lots of really important details in that record laying out what police knew at the time of his arrest. And it was just so difficult to get copies of that document. And I know I've experienced problems and my colleagues have experienced problems in other courthouses getting access to search warrants. These records that, like other court records, are supposed to be public.
Todd, tell us a little bit about the context when it comes to search warrants. Law enforcement needs to gather certain evidence to build a case against a potential suspect. How do they get a search warrant? How do they execute that warrant? And then where does all of that paperwork ultimately go, or where should it go?
Under the law, under most circumstances, to do a search, police need a sign-off of a judge showing that they have good grounds to do that. They have probable cause, that there is evidence that there was a crime committed, and that a search is actually going to turn up relevant evidence to that crime. So they're not just going on a goose chase looking for something bad to throw at somebody. So there is this process. Police or other investigators will normally file a request with the judge force to conduct a search, and it will generally contain an affidavit from a police officer or somebody else explaining the reasons and facts and basis for that search. Those are initially confidential for a short window of time so that it doesn't alert the person who's being searched or their property being searched. So there's a limited window of time before that search warrant is approved and executed where it is supposed to be confidential. But after that period, which is usually a few days or a week, it's supposed to be available so the public can see whether that search was indeed justified. What was the basis for that search? And to give people greater confidence in what police and courts are authorizing. But that transparency isn't of much value if people like me, even experienced reporters, can go to the courthouse and can't find the documents or are turned away, or the clerks who maintain the documents say that they can't find them.
So we had one of our legal fellows spend some time last summer looking into this issue, calling around, visiting courthouses, trying to determine just what the policies are. And we found this patchwork of various policies determining where these search warrant documents should be stored, if they're stored at all, how long they should be stored for, which can make it, as you said, really difficult to get this information when you're reporting a story, trying to determine the circumstances under which that particular search warrant was issued. How in the Campbell story did you get that search warrant information? Did you have to go to another source? Did you work with the courts? How long of a process was it before you got what you needed?
Yeah. So in this case, we spent months trying to work with the courts to find this document. We initially went to the Central District of the Boston Municipal Court multiple times. They couldn't find it. We complained to the administration office of the trial court and asked them for help. That didn't help. We went to three other possible courts where we thought there might be the documents. They couldn't find the documents. Ultimately, we wound up getting the documents from the prosecutors, from the district attorney's office in Suffolk County. If they had not given us the documents, we would have been out of luck and we would be missing key pieces of the story.
So good news is you finally got the information. Bad news is we still have this existing issue where these documents can be very difficult to find if they're found at all. In fact, some clerks are misinformed about whether or not search warrant and applications for search warrants are public in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think every clerk understands that they're public, and some say they can only provide them if you have the docket number, basically the court ID for this document, which no member of the public will ever have, or knew the specific date that it was returned to the police. So after it's been executed, the police are supposed to return a document explaining what was seized in the search. Typically, we wouldn't know that. And the biggest problem is there is no standard public index available of all the searches that have been conducted. There's this computer system called Mass Courts that lists every criminal case, every civil case, but search warrants aren't listed there. There is no public index that I've ever seen. I think I've heard that some courts may have an index, but it is not uniform. And there are big questions about what these indexes are, how they're kept, and who has access to them. But search warrants appear to be very different from most other records that are listed in a public court index so that journalists and any member of the public can find them.
And that shouldn't be the case. That's why NEFAC jumped in, wrote to the courts requesting certain changes be made, including a policy that requires such an index to be provided to the public so they can get easier access to these documents, as well as guidance to clerks to make sure that everybody's on the same page as far as knowing that these documents are in fact public and should be accessible to anyone who comes into the courthouse to obtain them. So hopefully these changes will be made. But if not, Todd, can you tell us what kind of stories are in jeopardy here? What stories aren't going to be told if journalists like yourself don't have access to these types of documents?
It makes it really difficult without these documents to know how the police are operating, how the criminal justice system is functioning. There are a lot of types of documents that are restricted and aren't available. There are lots of police reports that are not available to the public, lots of investigative reports that are not available to the public. One of the few windows into how a police operate is court records. And this is a key court record that shows how police were conducting an investigation and the basis for searches. I think it's really helpful for journalists to be able to access these documents, and they're public as a matter of law. They're public as a matter of court policy. So it's just a matter of figuring out how do we make the system work so the courts actually make the information available that they're supposed to.
Thanks again for listening to the NEFAC report. Join us next time when we speak with Megan Ryan at the National Freedom of Information Coalition about open government trends she is seeing throughout the country. Here's a preview.
There are those people who are using public records to try to grind government to a halt. But those kinds of restrictions, those attempts to try to deal with those kinds of requesters really threaten to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
We'll also hear from Sawyer Loftus at the Bangor Daily News about a promise made nearly 10 years ago in Maine to put all public court records online, a promise that remains largely unfulfilled.
That original system that was pitched and promised by the Maine judicial branch was supposed to be similar in function to the federal courts. But, you know, almost 10 years later, it is not quite ending up like that.
This program is produced by the New England First Amendment Coalition in partnership with Roger Williams University's Communities of Hope and under the guidance of Professor Bernardo Mata. I want to give a shout out to our student team, David Peters and Matthew Downey for the editing, Anna Pellegrini for the program logos, Will Feingold for music, Sarah Price for the show notes, along with Brianna Freisora and Lex Benson-Amaranti for production assistance. We'll see you next time.